On behalf of Judges Richter, Dolan, and myself, I'd like to welcome you to the Missouri Court of Appeals. Are there any informal matters before we begin? Would the attorney for each party stand, give your name, the name of the party represented, and announce how much time you wish to reserve for oral argument? Today is an accelerated case. You have 10 minutes for argument, 2 minutes for rebuttal, and the respondent will have 10 minutes. If you're not familiar with the room, there's a timer on the podium, shows how many minutes of time you have remaining. It's also adjustable for height. Our marshal today is Alvin Chamberlain. He'll rap twice when you have 2 minutes remaining and one rap when your time has expired. Please announce.
Jane Duker, representing appellant and testee Penny Hubbard.
Your time?
I would like to reserve all the time.
Okay, 10 and 2.
Dave Rowland, representing the contestant respondent, Bruce Franks. I would like to use all 10 minutes of my time.
Okay, thank you. You may proceed. Excuse me, sir. That's the only camera allowed in the courtroom today. Thank you.
May it please the court. Thank you for having us on such an expedited basis.
I imagine everybody had a really nice weekend. I know we did.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you. Fundamental to our democracy is the right to vote. But that vote doesn't mean anything if your vote's not counted. And in this case, we have 4,316 qualified and registered voters who voted in the August 2nd primary election for the 78th House District for the Missouri House. It's undisputed that every voter in this case voted for the candidate that they wanted to vote for. It's undisputed that every voter was registered and qualified to vote. It's undisputed that every single voter did everything that the local election authority asked them to do. It's also undisputed that the local election authority, the Board of Election, has utilized touchscreen and OptiScan voting for in-person absentee balloting for 10 years and did so pursuant to a statewide regulation promulgated by the Secretary of State pursuant to his statutory authority. But all 4,316 voters have now been disenfranchised based on a technicality that has nothing to do with either the authenticity or the veracity of a single vote.
How are they disenfranchised?
Because their vote has been taken away. And the right to vote.
Isn't there another election set for this Friday?
Well, for all intents and purposes, because it was called on a Friday before a long weekend, there are 160 people on the permanently disabled list. And they are automatically given applications because, for obvious reasons, they're not mobile. And those applications were not even mailed out until Tuesday.
And last Tuesday.
Correct. But they were required to be back at the election authority, which if you give a day or two for mail, then they get them. And if they didn't turn them around in a day, in less than a day, to get them back, they have a significant chance of not even being able to vote. The fact that you set an election on a Friday is also very confusing. And most people don't expect an election in, 14 days on a Friday after hearing about it on a holiday. And so taking away someone's vote, whether it's not counted and it's improperly not counted, that is disenfranchising. And the idea that there could be an exponential reduction in the number of people who vote in the special election, we'll end up having far less people actually decide this election. And the 540 people who voted absentee are effectively going to have their right removed because it's impossible to get that many votes done. And most of these people can't get to the election board. So the same people who went in and used the machines are going to be the same people that are going to be able to go back to the election board and be able to do that. So the 142 that are the subject of this case are going to be the least affected. It's going to be the other of the 540 who voted absentee or 530 that voted absentee who are going to be adversely affected. And as you can tell from the petition in this case and the exhibits, that many of the absentee ballots are located in low-income, minority, poor population, and so the idea that they will be disenfranchised for nothing that they did. The voter, it is undisputed that the voter could have done nothing to keep his vote counted. And so I think the case law in Missouri is clear, and actually Missouri is actually more protective of voting rights than the federal. And the law is clear that technical violations of statute that don't have anything to do with fraud, the court was very clear, he found no fraud, not a single vote was fraudulently cast. That in the absence of fraud, in absence of anything that the voter themselves could do, you don't throw out elections. Especially,
I would like you to address the issue of legal fraud versus actual fraud as it was discussed in Barks and some of the cases that preceded Barks.
I think the court in those cases refers to legal fraud as something that just you basically didn't follow statute. And so it is my belief that given the circumstances of the case and the trial record in this case, that the trial court did not mean legal fraud. In fact, he didn't refer to that at all in his order. It was fraud as in somebody had done something inappropriate. And that, because there has been a lot swirling around about that, but there was no evidence presented whatsoever. Now, the issue of legal fraud, which hasn't been used in a lot of the more modern cases, but it basically is that even if you unknowingly did it and you didn't follow a statute, that somehow that could be deemed, quote, legal fraud. But, you know, the most instructive case is the Rizzo case. And the Rizzo case was very clear that if there isn't any evidence that the votes would have turned out any differently, I mean, that's what is fundamentally flawed in his entire case. None of the technical violations that he is referring to with regard to the in-person absentee actually have any effect on a single vote. And so, you know, for example, the fact that you didn't put it in an envelope. The envelope does two things. One, you state your reason. Two, you affirm that you are the person you are and that you are not going to vote twice and that you're qualified to be there. Well, when you come in absentee to vote, one, you're in front of two election judges, bipartisan, one Republican, one Democrat. You come in and they verify your identity. They go to the MCVR, which is the voter database. They check your signature. You fill out an application, the bottom of which says if you lie on this, it's an election, you know, a first-class election offense. And they determine you are who you are, and they determine that you have not voted before. And because you're voting directly there, they make sure that you're on the list so that you can't vote again on election day. It's actually a much safer way to vote. So every safeguard that the envelope is supposed to provide for an absentee voter is taken care of in person in an actually much safer environment. And so, you know, in this case, the idea that you would throw out an entire election because of 142 people who voted in a much safer environment and a much more, with much less opportunity to commit fraud or to somehow frustrate the voting process, violates these people's right to vote. And I think that in this case, it's especially difficult because the election board has been operating pursuant to a statewide regulation for 10 years. That allows electronic voting. These machines were paid for with HAVA money. And if you take the money, you have to follow the federal law and you have to have compliant machines. And we've been using these compliant machines all over the state. And there was a regulation that was promulgated by the Secretary of State that was pursuant to then her authority under 225 that said, notwithstanding any other provision of law, you can promulgate rules that allow you to store ballots electronically. In this case, you would be frustrating the whole idea of a machine if you force people, one, to take an additional ballot so you could put it in an envelope, or two, to somehow dismantle the machine, which would actually violate federal law.
That's what the statute says, isn't it?
Well, I think the provision in 225 that specifically says that you can store the ballot information in the machine overrides, that's a later enacted statute that actually overrides the envelope requirement when you use the machines for in-person in absentee balloting.
When you say that all of the safeguards that the ballot envelope provides were taken care of in person with the application, what about the oath? There was no oath. They didn't attest that they were, that they were sworn under penalty of perjury. That's a safeguard that wasn't used.
The absentee application that they are required to sign specifically says, under penalty of perjury, if you lie on an absentee application, you are guilty of a Class 1 election offense, which also, because it goes toward the right of suffrage, would prevent you from ever being able to vote again, in addition to whatever other felony penalties you're subjected to. So the voter knows when they sign it that if they lie on this application, that they will be subject to the same offense that if they lied on an absentee ballot envelope. It's the same penalty.
Well, then why did the statute make different provisions?
Well, the statute was enacted before we had electronic machines, and that's why the electronic machines authority given to the Secretary of State under 225 and actually 227 modifies that and says, notwithstanding any other provisions of law, the Secretary of State is allowed to implement this and allow the storage of electronic ballots. And also, the regulation was duly promulgated by the Secretary of State, and the Circuit Court in this case doesn't have jurisdiction within an election contest to declare a statewide regulation invalid, which is what he did. He basically said this regulation is not supported by statute, so it's invalid. So the local election authority has no way of ever figuring out that at some point their authority will be overturned, and then you're going to retroactively take away everybody's vote. Did that, I see my time is up. Is that, did I answer your question?
You did.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor.
May it please the court. I regret that in the rush to get a brief filed, I overlooked one very important legal provision that I'd like to bring to the court's attention right now. It may be found on legal file page 11. It is chapter 115, section 007. It states, no part of sections 115.001 to 115.801 shall be construed as impliedly amended or repealed by subsequent legislation if such construction can be reasonably avoided. Your Honors, that disposes of the argument that Ms. Hubbard's attorney just presented, that this statute that gives the Secretary of State flexibility to provide guidelines for how electronic voting machines might be used somehow allows the Secretary of State to completely disregard an entire section of statutes providing specific, clear requirements for how absentee voting is to take place in the state. Additionally, Your Honors, I'll point to the text of the regulation itself. This is 15 CSR 30-10.080, subsection 1. It says, all jurisdictions using electronic data processing tabulation systems may conduct absentee balloting by the same means, and then critically, the requirements of Chapter 115 RSMO shall be followed. The absentee voting provisions are part of Chapter 115. This regulation says those provisions shall be followed. Your Honors, we made clear in our brief that for at least a century, Missouri courts have dealt with this question of the difference between a voter's constitutional right to cast a ballot on election day at their polling place versus this special statutory privilege that has been created allowing voters to cast absentee ballots. There is no constitutional right to cast an absentee ballot, and for an entire century, the Missouri Supreme Court has made clear that if a person attempting to cast an absentee ballot does not follow the statutes that have been put in place to govern the use of those ballots, that vote is invalid and should not be counted. We've cited, I believe, four or five cases that address these kinds of circumstances. Contrary to the briefing that you were presented by Ms. Hubbard's attorney, I've searched those cases in vain for an indication that the persons casting those absentee ballots were not registered voters, or that there was dispute over the question of whether those were registered voters. To the best of my awareness, in each of those cases, these were registered voters who attempted to use the absentee balloting process but did not comply with the statute's requirements. In several of these cases, the court specifically addressed the question of what if it wasn't the voter who made the mistake? What if the mistake was made by the election authority? And in each of those instances, the court said it does not matter. If the election authority makes the mistake, the law still has been violated. And in each of these cases, as we pointed out, it says compliance with the absentee ballot statutes is mandatory. Failure to comply with those statutes means that the votes should not have been counted. And in this case, there are a minimum of 142 votes that have been shown not to have been validly counted. And there's a maximum of about 238 votes that, based on the stipulations that opposing counsel made at the trial and which were included in the trial court's judgment, those votes did not comply with the statutes governing absentee ballots. Your honors correctly raised the question of actual fraud versus legal fraud. My client and I have made clear from the beginning of this case that we were not alleging that any particular voter intended to violate the law. What we contended is that some of these voters were misled. And in fact, the evidence shows that they were misled, in particular, by the Board of Election Commissioners. The Board of Election Commissioners allowed
the trial court's judgment found that there was no evidence of actual fraud in this instance. That's the judgment that we're presented with.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And as I'm pointing out, that is a difference between I'm saying that we were not alleging actual fraud on the part of the voters. What we were clearly alleging was legal fraud. The Missouri Supreme Court has made clear since 1911 in the Gantt case that this is an important distinction to make. I'll quote from the Gantt case itself. In that case, the contestants charged fraud in the election, both actual fraud and what might be denominated legal fraud. The court went on to say that because fraud is fraud, whether it be actual or legal, the classification is immaterial. It says that a person in good faith and without intention to work a fraud upon any person might cast a vote, and yet the vote would be illegal. Such a vote, in law, works a fraud upon the person against whom it is cast and would be denominated a legal fraud. Where fraud is charged in good faith in the petition, it can make no difference in a case, such as here, whether the fraud be actual or whether it might be denominated legal fraud. Your Honors, that is a Missouri Supreme Court case that has never been overturned, and in fact, it has been cited to support some of the later cases dealing with absentee ballots. Opposing counsel made no effort to distinguish between the Rizzo case, in which no absentee ballots were at issue. There was no question of whether the mandatory requirements of absentee ballot statutes were complied with. And the other cases that we cited, including Barks, including Elliott, including Strawn, which said that, look, when we are dealing with this special statutory privilege that's been created by the legislature, compliance with the letter of the law is mandatory. And we have a couple of these cases, including Elliott, that specifically point out that it also, when we're dealing with the absentee ballot statutes, it doesn't matter whether the statute expressly says that a ballot has to be rejected for a specific reason or not. They've said compliance with all of these statutes is mandatory. Now, to go to the question of whether a specific statutory requirement has been violated, we actually did point out, and the court below found, that several of the absentee ballot statutes were violated. The section of statutes that deal with absentee ballots are replete with instructions regarding the ballot envelope. It is a critical part of this process. For example, in 115.291, which spells out how an absentee ballot is supposed to be cast, it says, upon receiving the ballot, the voter has to mark the ballot in secret, place the ballot in the envelope, seal the envelope, fill out the statement on the ballot envelope. There has to be an affidavit of each person voting absentee that is subscribed and sworn. And in fact, that affidavit is on the ballot envelope. All of these provisions have been violated by this parallel procedure that the Board of Election Commissioners set up, where there's no law that governs how this parallel procedure works. It does not provide the same safeguards provided in statute. It is not the same as the protections afforded in statute. And I'd like to point out, in addition to the problem of there not being a sworn oath, which is, of course, a serious problem, when the law says an oath must be sworn, that's mandatory. But in addition, Your Honors, there is no opportunity to challenge a ballot that's cast in person at the polls. Once that ballot is cast, it is divorced from the person who cast it. So whereas the statutory procedures allow for an election day challenge to be made when a ballot is taken out of its envelope, no such challenge is possible under the shadow procedure that the election commissioners set up to allow for in-person voting on these machines. Lastly, Your Honors, this could all be avoided if the election authority simply required whatever ballot is marked on in the offices of the board to be placed in an absentee ballot envelope and then returned to the board that day. At that point, the envelopes could be kept together as required in statute. They could be prepared as required by statute. They could be challenged as required by statute. And more importantly, they would have the statements and the oath that the statutes require that for this election were not required for at least 142 of the ballots that were counted. Because those 142 ballots were legal fraud under the longstanding definitions, may I finish my sentence, Your Honors? Under the longstanding definitions of the Missouri Supreme Court, they were unlawfully counted in this case, and as the trial court found, the validity of the underlying election is in doubt. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
Okay, with regard to opposing counsel's statement that there are no cases that indicate that you can violate absentee statutes and the court still reviews as to whether it's material and whether you should throw out an election. Specifically in the case of Elliott versus Hogan, the Supreme Court, while they determined that there were too many violations of the absentee statute to not order a new election, it specifically went through the analysis and it specifically held that where the irregularity has been such as to not have interfered with a full and fair expression of the voter's choice, particularly where it is a mistake of an election official, the irregularity should not result in the disenfranchisement of voters. Two things. One, the courts have long recognized that taking away somebody's vote and not having it counted as disenfranchisement. Also, this indicates that the absentee ballots are subject to the same rules that we don't disenfranchise people for irregularities that have no bearing whatsoever on a single vote. What counsel has not and cannot tell you is that any of the gotcha technical violation that he is asserting had any impact on whether a registered voter voted for the person that they wanted to vote for. And so I think that's fatal to his claim. And in fact, what he's asking is for this court to overtake the will of the people who voted. And they all expressed their will, and there's no evidence or indication otherwise. Also, we did file a motion to strike that I would like to have your honors look at that indicates he did not appeal the judge's order that the other issues of irregularity that were presented were an irregularity at all. He didn't appeal that, so that's not here for your court's review. Also, he did not ask for an order declaring the regulation that the local election authorities have been operating under invalid, so he can't now complain be heard on that. Let's see.
I think time's expired. Yeah.
Thank you.
The motion will be taken with the case, and the case is under submission. Thank you.